Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Salieri Report. This is Catherine Austin Fitz and host of his own Salieri Report, Junius Ricardo Stanton. We're in the Philadelphia area. It's great to see you, Junius. Yes,
great to be seen. In an upright position.
Anyway, so I've wanted for a long time to have a conversation with Junius about leadership. And I kept waiting, hoping I could read lots of books about leadership and get more expertise in leadership. But I've decided, no, we're here. We're just going to talk about leadership. And it's really leadership for the real deal. Mm-hmm. I told you I watched Kennedy's presidential announcement. Right. Have you seen it? I don't know if you've
seen it. I saw snippets of it.
Snippets. And I decided, I called John Rappaport and I said, I want to do an interview called The Things You're Not Allowed to Talk About at the Cocktail Party. Because Kennedy was clearly avoiding certain topics. And you know, he was very forthright about many, many important things in a way far beyond any candidate ever could be. So, you know, he gets a huge gold star. At the same time, you could see there were certain places.
He wouldn't go.
He wouldn't go. You know, because he's trying to build, I know what he's trying to do. He's trying to build a certain percentage consensus. He's trying to get enough people in the thing. So I thought, okay, and so John said, no, I want to talk about that. So I asked you, when we talk about leadership, can we talk about leadership in a world where you're not supposed to talk about a lot of different things at the cocktail party? Because that's part of handling leadership. I thank you for doing this. So this is...
Thank you for the invitation.
Leadership for the real deal. So the reason I wanted to do this with you is I deeply admire your leadership skills. We met many years ago in Chester, Pennsylvania. Do you remember?
Yeah, you took me before then, Chester.
Well, we did a show. We did one or two shows together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think you called me.
I heard about you. And I contacted you, and at that time, you were still in Philadelphia.
Right.
And I had an internet radio program, so right. We did the live program.
Right.
Then you invited me to the Unanswered Questions piece down in Washington, D.C.
Right.
Then you invited me to Chester to meet with the gentleman who was familiar with what happened at Sunship.
Right. So it was the former president of Sunship, and he had a key TAM. And I was trying to teach him about what was going on. He was trying to teach me about sort of his key TAM. But I decided Chester was a great place. You know, if you look at what you were working on and I was working on and what he was working on, a lot of it, Chester was a real case study on what the deep state had been doing and what I call the beatdown. You know, when you come into a place and you really take advantage, you liquidate, you do lots of things.
Locust kind of effect, you know.
Yeah. And, you know, one of my contentions in the 90s was if we let this happen, you know, in some places, ultimately it's going to happen every place, which is
now,
in fact.
Now we're seeing that.
But you had dealt with the beatdown in a variety of different ways, both personally and professionally. Because of your work, you know, I was writing about the prison system, but you had dealt with the prison system as a probation.
As a probation officer. Right.
But we also had a lot of, you know, we had a Philadelphia background, we had a Penn background, we had a lot of worlds in common. But if you look at all the evil that you had watched or observed or dealt with, you still somehow managed to, like a bolo dog, get up every day and do something productive. And you just had a pathway that was always productive and was always open to listening. You were always, you're a very good listener when you meet somebody. You know, you kind of...
Well, yeah.
So you're like an MRI. So here was somebody who just always was leading, you know, and leading in a, you know, you kind of sneak around. So you don't lead, you don't shout, you don't make a lot of noise. You just...
Stealth.
Yeah, you kind of stealth. Yeah. But absolutely committed to leadership. And you seem to keep a remarkable balance. And so what I thought was, you know, whose leadership skills do I really admire? And it's you. I really admire your leadership skills.
But you know what? I don't think of myself as a leader
really?
In that sense.
Right.
I mean, I think of myself as a catalyst for some things.
Right.
Because of writing, I get a chance to put ideas out there
Right.
to, and because of the radio, I got a chance to bring people like you on to expose whoever was listening to people like you, and then
Right.
you introduced me to so many other people, and I had
Right.
them on the program
Right.
that it created another perspective that the people that I envision my audience, I mean, urban dwellers or basically African Americans, but I really didn't know because it was the internet. The internet was, remember, this was back in the 90s, early
Right.
90s.
So we're just
Yeah, and I was a
discovering.
pioneer. We were pioneers in internet radio,
Right.
So that whole, and we made friends, we remained friends, and we made contact with other people. This has been going on over 20 some years.
So I call it an actionable intelligence network. In other words, we're all trying to figure out what's going on,
Right.
and we need, I call it maps. We need maps. And the only way, it's a complex world, the only way you can put together good maps is to have networks of people you can trust. So the best intelligence we get at Solari is from the subscribers. They're,
Right. People on the ground.
right,
Right.
they're on the ground and they're sending in information. Oh, this is what's going on. And, and so I think that's kind of what you and I have been doing. But, if you look at your history, you've seen many things that could turn you angry, turn you bitter, turn you not in a state of love, and yet you've managed to always, not to go there, but to focus
Well,
instead
I've been
on.
on the fringes.
Well, that's a blessing.
No, but I'm saying there were times where I found myself I was constantly angry about stuff.
Yeah.
But
But you don't stay there.
no, because that's not a good place to be,
Right.
right? And me being angry is not hurting what's going on. It's not hurting the external situation. It's hurting me. Personally, health-wise, the whole bit, psychologically, emotionally.
Well, I always tell the story during the litigation when I realized, look in the mirror one day and I realized, oh, you're dying. This is not you. Whatever your plan is, it's not working. So I did. I said, I'm going to go back and study who this happened to and who succeeded and who failed and why. And what I discovered is all the people who failed got angry and they took their anger out on themselves and people around them. And they literally poisoned themselves with their anger. And that's when I realized, oh. And that's when I went to the Bible Institute and I started getting training in spiritual warfare. And without that, I would have just gone to incredible anger.
Well, but if when you look at that, what motivated you to do that? Because see, that wasn't some external force or external person. That was something within you that told you, I need to do something.
So I'll tell you exactly what it was. So I'd grown up in West Philadelphia. And I had personal friends who were African American, who were very devout Christians. And I knew that they knew they had the technology. We lived in West Philadelphia. We lived through the beatdown. So I was there from,
Oh, you should see it
yeah,
now.
yeah. So I lived through the beatdown. I saw how the beatdown worked. And one of the things I watched, and it helped me to do all the mapping of the money that I did when I was at HUD and we were working as the HUD financial advisor. But what you would see is a group of people external to the neighborhood would bring in the drugs, then they'd bring in the enforcement, they'd basically rape the place, they'd use lots of government money to do a variety of things, and then they'd get on TV and they would blame the people
Blame,
who lived in the neighborhood. So there was this gaslighting, which if you hadn't lived through it, you didn't understand how powerful it was. And then they'd bring in these government grants and get the young kids in the neighborhood to like hook up in the grants and take photos with them about how they're helping. Do you know what I mean? So they get to be the good guy and dad and mom get to be the bad guy. And
And
it's,
meanwhile, nothing improves.
oh, it gets worse. So, because now you've got You've got a psychological corruption on top of the financial corruption. And then all the people getting killed with the drugs and everything else.
Right.
So I don't know if I ever told you this. After the budget deal in 1995, when they essentially they gave up on trying to get a financially responsible solution, the next month the FDA approved OxyContin, and the pill mills started literally, if you look at the predatory lending from HUD and the pill mills, it was like that. And it was obvious, okay, we can't get the savings up. We'll take the life expectancy down. It was, boom, boom.
Well, when you look at that, when you explain that, then you look at what's going on now, where the life expectancy is dropping precipitously
Right.
over the last 3 years,
Right.
you can really literally chart that now.
And I associate, it started before then. I call it the
Correct,
grape poisoning.
right.
But what you saw at that October 1995 date was after that, you saw this enormous acceleration of the grape poisoning. I mean, the GMO and all the food problems skyrocketed right in 96. You had all sorts of predatory lending and usury that skyrocketed. You had the fentanyl, the OxyContin, the pill mills, everything skyrocketed. The illegal drugs
Right,
skyrocketed.
right, right.
Everything skyrocketed. And it was both health and finance, this pincer movement that really matured into the
But
pandemic.
don't forget the skyrocketing of the drugs, the psychotropic drugs, the prescription drugs. I understand what you're saying about the
Right.
OxyContin and all that, and what you mean in terms of the street. But look at how Big Pharma and Big Med
Yep.
colluded to put so many young people on these drugs.
So it was amazing because I was working with Kelly O'Meara on articles about Ritalin and getting kids on Ritalin, and I moved to Tennessee, and one of my neighbors had just retired early because she was so heavily lobbied. One of the things that pushed her out, she was being lobbied by the parents to certify the kids as ADHD. So they could get Social
That
Security
right,
disability
yeah.
because they needed that money to feed the kids. I mean, it was off. So they're trying to drug the kids and get them on. But what you could see in the 2000s was you would drive into a town. I was driving all over America, and they're building a criminal justice center, and then they're building a new hospital. And what you realize was, oh, all the illegal drugs, they're going to process everybody through the criminal justice center, but all the people have health care insurance. They're going to process them through the hospital, and if you looked at the build out of the pharmaceutical, it was hospitals, doctor's office, all the grocery stores were significantly reducing the space for groceries and increasing the space for drugs. And so what you saw was you had two drug games. One was illegal, one was legal, but if you looked at the illegal one and if you looked at both of the business, it's all pain management. And the question is, why is everybody in pain? Anyway, so what I realized on a place-based basis, the legal and illegal drugs are managed as one business. It's one strategy.
Because all the money was being funneled to the big banks. They were doing the money laundering. So you had the collusion between the banks and to some degree law enforcement. And even the politicians. So the system is slowly being corrupted, and eventually it's going to get to the point where there's almost no redemption possible.
So going back to what I was saying, so I had grown up in West Philadelphia, and I had a lot of personal friends in the African American churches. And I knew they knew how to deal with this. I knew they had the technology of how you deal with a beatdown and how you deal with genocide. When you are a target of genocide, what do you do? How do you manage it? When your enemy is much, much more powerful than you are, and the dominant culture believes your enemy, not you. And so I knew they knew how to deal with this. And that's what I did. I found a great church with a great Bible institute, and I studied for 2.5 years, and I consumed all the knowledge of how to deal with this. And I really studied the Bible because, a lot of the technology is in the Bible. It's in Scripture. And I learned an enormous amount. I was like a vacuum cleaner because I was convinced this was the only way I could succeed. And so I knew it was there. And it was really interesting because many, many times I've tried to tell other people, it's there, go get it. At the same time, it seems to be draining away, because they're trying to get the churches on the,
On the dole.
they're trying to get the churches on the dole. But then these things intercede that stop anyone from doing that, like Black Lives Matter, because the whole divide and conquer is to turn everybody against each other. So I was kind of, I feel like I kind of lucked out because I had enough in my background. And it was interesting because when I had to make the key decisions about whether I was going to go or stay in terms of being in the establishment, I had two people in my mind, and they had to do with, okay, who do you really love and who do you really care about? And the person, there were two people, and one was one of the most powerful, prominent people in the world who I really loved, and the other was one of the poorest people I ever knew who I really loved. And I just went with the poor person because they had more integrity. And it's funny because it took me many, many years later to figure out that the other person had betrayed me, which I hadn't
Okay, right, you
faced.
didn't really
I
see
hadn't,
that,
yeah, I hadn't faced early on. And, thank God I chose, but it was a spiritual decision. It was not a material decision. Because if it had been a material decision, I would have gone with the rich and the powerful. And,
Well, but see, intuitively, you understood not on a conscious level, but the rich and powerful, like you said, were the ones who were betraying you, even though you didn't know specifically who the people were, but you saw, because it wasn't the poor people that came after you. It was the rich and powerful.
it was the people who were going after the poor people, so
Because
because the
you inadvertently, you were thwarting their plan. You came and, the way your mind works, you came with you said, hey, this is not working. We can come up with a better idea, more efficient way to use the money and actually help people behind closed doors. I said, she's crazy. We got to get rid of her.
Well, here's the thing. They had three choices. They could re-engineer the model, which was what I was where, and I thought I had their full permission and encouragement to do what I was doing. I thought I was trying to find, that plan B. So you can re-engineer the model. That's one thing. You can depopulate. That's another thing. Or you can just keep the current thing going as long as it can by brutal force. Those were your choices. And so my attitude is, I don't think your plan is. They think depopulation will work. We'll get them to where they want to go. And it's safer because if you're in position, you don't want to take the risk of a meritocracy system because how are you going to transition the risk management along the way? So they don't think it, they don't think
It's too much
another.
effort, to do what you were trying to do. And plus it impacts their bottom line. And also, see, a lot of times we think it's all about money.
No,
It's
it's
not.
not. It's
It's
not.
about power.
Right. So I don't think they saw a way to evolve the domestic model and still win at the international game. So I think it was a challenge of managing the international game in combination with the domestic. But they clearly decided democracy doesn't work, and so you've got to do the financial coup and end democracy, and that's. Now is when they're lowering the boom. So, yeah. So anyway, it's because I always said if somebody wanted someone to represent the establishment in a court of law, I could make the most empathetic argument on their behalf because I know how hard it is to manage their positions and how hard it is to run them. And it's a lot harder than you think. And the corruption of the general population is a lot worse than we all want to believe. So, so I've always had a lot of empathy, but I've always felt that their plan was just really stupid. I
Because
don't
you're
think it's
not
going to
that,
work.
well, yeah, but you're not that kind of person. See, the people who are psychopaths, they don't care. They have no moral compass. They have no sense of responsibility. And just by you recognizing you're an empathetic person, empathy means you have some compassion or feeling. It goes beyond sympathy. It's another level where, sympathies are, well, you feel sorry for somebody. Empathy is, well, you really care about them. You resonate with them beyond that immediate situation.
Well, here's what we don't know. We don't know all the risks they're dealing with. So, my big question, and you hear us talk about it on News Trends and Stories all the time on the quarterly wrap-ups, is, what are the geophysical risks they know about that we don't know about? Because the thing that's eating us all alive is secrecy. And one of the reasons a lot of the decisions I would say are bad decisions have been made is because there's so much built-up secrecy, they can't bring the secrecy down. There's too many liabilities. And as you
But the other
said,
thing too, with it, there's secrecy, but then there's deception. So that creates a real conundrum for them,
So
because they can't trust each other.
they can't trust each other. So, I learned a lot about that over the last 10 or 20 years. So the challenge of leadership in this environment is I feel like we're walking through, it's like walking through a minefield. And you have on one side, everybody's trying to stay in the middle of the road, and the middle of the road is going away. You can either go with God or you can go with the demonic, because we are dealing with true evil here. I mean, true evil. And I think part of the challenge of being you or me is we've been trying to warn people about the real evil and they don't want to hear it.
Well, but stop and think about what that means. It means that they would have to admit that the level of evil and wickedness is so high and so intense. And if you don't have that spiritual knowledge or that spiritual connection, you're overwhelmed. So it's easier for them to pretend not to know what's going on. Because, first of all,
Well, that's what I did until I had no choice. I
but
mean, I only.
you were put in that position, but see, you didn't quit. You didn't give up.
Well, but you had to choose. For me, because for every one of us, the middle of the road goes away sooner or later. So you were
You run
saying
that
African
dead end.
Americans were in the canary in the
Where
coal mine. They lost the middle option. Most of them, not all of them, most people lost the middle option earlier. But, so this losing of the middle of the road option is something everybody has gone through
Eventually,
or is going to go through, and you got to choose. You got to choose God or you got to choose the devil. There's no.
But when you went, and that's true, but look at what they're doing. They're doing everything to make choosing God not even a conscious thought. So stop in just the past 3 years. If you're facing a serious challenge, and then one of your policy is to close down religious buildings, close down the one source of inspiration and hope that people have that doesn't cost them anything. Clearly, there's something demonic about that. So the very fact that now, and they now they openly admit that they're attempting to suppress the very part of us that is connected to God, with whatever you want to call it, God. So this whole movement to transhumanism is anti-God. And people don't want to admit that because they bought into the movies, they bought into all the sci-fi movies, all the Cyborg and all that kind of stuff, but then they don't really understand the real implication. What does that mean to you or for
Right.
you and your family and your children, your grandchildren?
Okay, so you're walking through the world. Junius is walking through his world, and you're watching this middle of the road going away, including in your life in front of you. And you're having to constantly make these choices. And you have to make these choices and still, you have to go through change, and you have to learn to adapt and still hold on to your power to love and your power to create. So how did you do that?
I think it was watching the people around me, people who had survived major trauma, but they found a way to keep on going on. They weren't bitter. They might have been hurt. They were definitely damaged, but they found a way to keep on going on, to try to have a sense of community. So I saw that. My mother was like a real mystic. Like she was into she was into different organizations, and she strong willed person. My father died when I was three, so I didn't have that element. I did have his family, but I saw my mother, and I think because of that, I gravitated to some spiritual illness. One day I was walking down the street, I found a copy of somebody had discarded a little small copy of the New Testament. I picked it up, took it on. I was probably like a teenager, and I started reading it. It probably planted the seeds in my psyche. So I became receptive. I was always looking for spiritual or religious, trying to find certain things. So I think that was the seed that planted the seed growing up in the church and all of that. And I'm not talking about religion. I'm just talking about the at the core essence of spirituality, meaning who you are, what's your connection, and what's your connection to not only your family, but people, your connection to the earth. And when you understand how important that is, you have an obligation to say, well, I don't want this to be destroyed.
So I'm just reading Ingo Swann. After he died, Nick Cook, who's a British journalist, worked with Ingo Swann's family and took two of his manuscripts and published them. It's called Resurrecting the Mysterious. And what he's saying, these are my words, not his, but what he's saying, Ingo Swann was one of the leading remote viewers and was supposed to be sort of a Leonardo kind of genius. And what he said was, part of our world is visible to the naked eye, and part of our world is not visible to the naked eye. And if you look at how we're living, we're taught to believe that what we can see with the naked eye is real and everything else is not. And he describes the efforts to control and keep us from, integrating the invisible. And I think what you're saying is you had a childhood where you had a mother who introduced you to the invisible, and so you knew it was there and you knew it was real.
But I it was more intuitive to also, and what you're describing is the belief system of indigenous people who have not been corrupted by the Industrial Revolution, have not been co corrupted by technology, have not been corrupted by materialism. And that whole idea of that there's something that is interpenetrating here right now and is with us right now is very real. It's just that we've been taught not to believe it or not to see the concept of the word nonsense means that I can't see it, I can't taste it, I can't touch it, I can't hear it, so it doesn't exist.
So Rappaport has this wonderful long audio that I sometimes listen to on long drives, where he takes you back in your imagination before the industrial age and the conversion of a human into a means of
A
production.
cog, yeah.
And he just takes you back to a whole different, to imagine a culture where humans really blossom as humans without all of what Charles Fort used to say, there's somebody who thinks we're property. So, before that, and it's quite remarkable, and you begin to understand, oh, if we could embrace the invisible, think of the power we would have to build civilization.
Or just the awe, and because of the arrogance of the technocrats, they look at people who have an awe and an inspiration about nature, about the fact that there's life. In the Gospel of Thomas, they asked Jesus, "Well, when is the kingdom of God coming?" He said, "Well, the kingdom of God is spread out upon the earth, but men don't see it." And so that's the awe that we've been denied, that they
It's
try to
such a beautiful
suppress.
planet. It's such a beautiful planet.
And there's life everywhere.
Yeah.
And so that energy that sustains life, that energy that keeps everything together, stops it from disintegrating and all of that, is there.
Right.
And it is at our disposal if we are willing to use it. Now, a lot of people come to it out of sheer desperation. They're at the end of their rope and say, "Okay, I can't go anywhere. Help." They
Yeah.
don't even know who they're calling. Help.
Yep.
And all of a sudden, things start happening. And if they're wise, I say, "Well, wait a minute. I called for some help, or I thought about it, or I dreamed
Yeah.
about it, and all of a sudden,
Here it
here
is.
it is." So how can I get that, and how can I stay as close to that as possible?
So one of my favorite preachers says, he says, the fear of the Lord is not fear of, a powerful guy who's going to punish you. Fear of the Lord is once you know that, once you have that, once you connect into that, losing that, you will do anything but to lose that. And
So
that's.
that's the thing. See, because we've been trained in religion as opposed to spirituality or mysticism. Only thing, all a mystic is someone who wants to know what you just described for themselves.
Right.
That's all that means. It's nothing spooky, it's nothing blasphemous or anything about that. It's about, I want to be in the flow, in the divine flow,
Right.
the force be with you, that
Right.
kind of thing.
Right. That's true. So I'm coming back to you and how you did, how you've done, because I do think of it as leadership, what you've done. I've listened to a lot of your interviews. And you just keep educating people and educating people and educating people. And you do it in a way which is very welcoming.
It's subtle. It's not, I don't try to beat people over the head
You
with
don't try and beat people
it.
over the head, and you try and engage them where they are. So how did you do that?
I think it's something that I developed when I started the radio program. And I think out of my experiences, everything where we are, we're the product of the choices that we make in our
Right.
experiences.
Right.
So my experiences as a probation officer,
Right.
listening to people, knowing that every day that I go to work, people are gonna lie to me,
Right.
the people try to get over on me or whatever.
Right.
So you learn not to take it
Personally.
personally.
Right.
So the thing is, real education is helping to cultivate and bring out what's already in you.
Did you, when you were a probation officer, did you ever see people really turn around and go right?
Some.
Did you ever think a lot about what you could do that would help them go right?
What I attempted to do was give them what they wanted. What they wanted was, most of them wanted to be, as we would say in the process, discharged from jurisdictional restraint,
Right.
meaning that they didn't have a monitor on their leg, they didn't have to report to me. didn't have me coming out to their house. They just wanted to be quote unquote free.
Right.
The last 12 years of my career, I worked out of Glenn Mills. I was in the aftercare unit. So now you're dealing with young men who have had their freedom taken from them.
Right.
So my thing is, okay, if I were in their place, what would I want?
Right.
I want to get out.
Right.
I want to get out in the shortest amount of time.
Right.
So that was my pitch to them. Okay, if you want to get out and you want to get out in the shortest amount of time, do these things. If you have the support of the staff and you have my support, more than likely, that's what's going to happen.
Right.
So they would do enough to get that. Because the first step is, okay, do this, you'll get a home pass.
Right.
After you're here 60 days, you're eligible for a home pass. But they're just not going to give it to you.
Right.
So they would do that to get what they wanted.
Right.
But in terms of actual turnaround, yeah, I saw some. But you got to remember, they left there, or even when I was in the other unit, they remained in that environment, that toxic environment, that right. non-supportive environment. There was some beauty there, but there was a lot of trauma.
So the only time I've ever seen people go right that I can think of offhand is they would get in the church and they would literally become a new person. Mm-hmm. They would change their mind mm-hmm. in a very right. deep right. way, mm-hmm. but they needed to be touched by a spirit that showed them they could change. Right. They could be different.
Right. Right.
So this was really about their own opinion of themselves.
Right.
And always. Something had to get them to believe that they could change.
Right. So the thing that kept me going for 32 years was that belief that everyone can change.
They can. Right.
Now, people change, my theory is people change for two reasons. External pressure, you know, you get a reward, you get punishment, coercion, threats, whatever. Or enlightened self-interest, you know.
Well, I also do believe in a miraculous intervention. I mean, I've had personal miracles happen that just completely, you know, it's like a whole body slap. And you realize, oh, the world's different than I thought. You know, it's like a wake-up call.
Right. But that's part of enlightened self-interest. In other words, you might not be thinking about change, but you come up on a situation or you find yourself in a certain predicament. And you look at your options. Or things are so bad that you just don't even think about it. And then you make the right decision.
Right.
Right. A lot of that is inner motivation. You're driven.
Right.
Other times you might meet someone. That person that has been divinely placed in your space at that particular time, at that right moment.
Right.
And some kind of way they have an impact on you.
Right.
And they may stay. They may just disappear. But they had an impact and they prompted you to make certain choices.
Right. And so I come back to you and leadership. I think each person, when I'm in a situation and I watch someone like you do something, which I think, wow, Junius really, you know, he really embodies qualities of leadership that I admire. It kind of ups my game.
Mm-hmm.
And I need that. I need to be around other people who help me up my game. I find it impossible to do it by myself.
Well, no one does it by themselves. Even though you have the power and the energy to do and accomplish great things,
right.
you have to be in a situation. You have to be in a situation where you're reinforced,
right.
your values are reinforced, or you get encouragement,
right.
or someone challenges you.
Right.
But you're not going to make it by yourself.
Right. Well, I always, you know, I was kind of trained to do the make it by yourself thing. Mm. And so it took me a long time to realize, okay, you know, in one sense, human beings are very fragile beings and they need, you know, we need to think very astutely and carefully about who we associate with, because we need that. You know, we need that. And if we don't get that, we're going to get something that's not what we need.
Well, we're energetic beings. And so part of the energy is the vibe. You know, in the old days, oh, Catherine gives off good vibes. Well, that's true, right? I mean, literally, that's true, right? And so you attract what you put out, right? So if you put out that you're vulnerable, that you're gullible, or you're afraid, you're uncertain, some unscrupulous person will come around and take advantage of that. But if you put that out and someone comes and says, hey, Catherine, come here. I want to share something with you.
It's a little bit like, you know, in West Philadelphia, you were taught when you walked down the street, you had to walk down the street like you were
Yeah, confident. Yep.
a killer.
Couldn't. Nah.
Yeah, you didn't want a
Mm-mm.
single
Mm-mm. Yeah.
okay, so I told you I watched Bobby Kennedy's speech announcing for presidency, and I thought it was a great speech. I thought he did a great job. And Kennedy has for many years now been trying to play to build a coalition. You know, he's trained, if you're a Kennedy and you're trained to, you know, deal in the rough and tumble of politics, which he's very good at, you're trained to build coalitions. And so he tries very hard to be inclusive. Now, I'm from a conservative tradition and we try to be exclusive. It's like, keep those guys out, you know. So he's trying to build an inclusive game, and he was very careful to avoid certain subjects. And that's why I told you I said, okay, we need to do a Slurry report called Things You're Not Allowed to Talk About at the Cocktail Party. And to me, the greatest challenge of leadership right now, you know, so the middle road is going away. You have to choose the divine, you have to choose the demonic. But you're in, you know, you're working every day with people who don't want to leave the middle of the road. They're kind of there, and you love them and you want to help them, but you know which way this is going to go. And the problem is there are certain topics that are, you know, not to be brought up at the cocktail table or at cocktail party. And the question is, how do you deal with that? How do you be a leader and deal with that? So, and I'm struggling, I have to admit, because I'll see somebody. So let's talk about one of the things we can't talk about, which is mind control technology. And I'm a bit of a broken record about mind control technology because I've dealt with it for so many years. And I came onto it early, among other things, because I just overheard a group of people on Wall Street talking about it. I wasn't supposed to hear it. And I really thought, you know, I could be in serious trouble if they knew I'd heard it. And, you know, but that was long ago. And I have literally watched my society be overwhelmed by this technology, as well as propaganda, as well as the finance, you know, because they dovetail. You got the financial incentives, you got the propaganda, you've got, you know, all sorts of sort of interference in the educational system, you know, and peer pressure. Then on top of it, you've got the internet and mind control coming through the smartphones or the. Somebody, I just watched a video. Somebody said ESPN has been, ESPN,
Yeah,
what's the sport?
sports.
Yeah, has been losing money for 10 years. Well, why would they lose money? You know, why would a business keep losing money for 10 years? My understanding is that the most brainwashing comes through the sports. That's how you get the men.
Well,
So,
now they're aiming at the ladies.
right. So that's why you would, you know, lose money for 10 years because you're not losing money. You're making money on the brainwashing of people. Okay, so we go into these audiences of people who are just completely divorced from reality, and they are doing things to themselves and their family which are killing them. And they are complicit. They are, you know, eating the food, taking the drugs, you know, taking the injections, and they and their family are being killed. But they're, you know. So how do you deal with that?
It's very difficult because when you present that information to them, they don't want to believe that people are that evil. That they why would if if a if we're in a consumer society, why would they want to kill me?
Right.
I'm buying their stuff. I'm buying into the products. I have the cars. I have the houses, the homes. The goal is control and domination. So just talk about the injection. So friends of mine would ask me, why didn't you're not going to take it? I said, no. So, what's your reason? I said, well, first of all, they haven't been adequately tested. I mean, if you look at what the process, that whole warp speed stuff, that's nonsense. So I lost contact with them. I mean, a lot of times it was like, well, he's crazy. So now things are happening to them. They're getting sick. They're having heart problems.
Right.
I can't go back to them and say, see, I told you.
Right. No, you can't.
So all you can do is be supportive. But at the same time, I'm still writing about it. I'm still talking about it. I'm still hoping that they will see from my example that, well, okay, he was right. Now, they're never going to admit that I was right,
Right.
but they'll say, okay, well, okay, I'm not going to take any more.
Right.
So that's the challenge. And it becomes even more delicate because you're going against a propaganda and suppression and censorship machine that is awesome.
Right.
I mean, I got to give it, I give them, hey, I give them credit for what they've done.
It's quite
But
remarkable.
yes, yeah, it is. It's literally, in the true meaning, incredible. It's unbelievable.
Well, how do you get people? I mean, anybody you and I talk to has many reasons for not trusting the government. Right?
Fear. But just to take it where you're going, African Americans, black people, were the one group that they targeted. Belinda Gates was saying, okay, how can we get the black people at the front of the line?
Right.
Remember after that was part of the George Floyd thing.
Right.
Get them at the front of the line to take the injections. And I tried to tell them, look, we of all people have a history of being abused by the medical system.
Right.
Why would you trust them?
Right.
And I had a friend of mine who was very into, oh, well, it's not like the Tuskegee experiment. What are you talking about? The Tuskegee experiment was like for 40 years. But the mind entrainment people won.
Right.
Right? So now I'm seeing that people don't even want to hear. It's not like I'm saying I told you so.
Right.
It's like, okay, this is what's going on.
Right.
This is the rollout now. This is what's happening. This is what the insurance companies are saying. This is
Right.
what is happening. Hey, the insurance are they're upset because they're paying out money,
Right.
but at the same time, there are people saying, okay, oh good, because now we don't have to pay off Social Security, we don't have to do this, the pensions, the annuities, and all that. It's just that people don't want to believe that there's this level of evil out there. So you just have to keep pushing. That's just like the prophets in the Bible. You tell them, folks, yay, it's gonna rain.
Right.
Rain? What's that?
So in the Rasmussen poll in January, 10% said, I think it was 10% that the said the injection had killed someone in their
Somebody they knew,
household or their family. And then the one in March said, I think 25 plus percent knew someone who'd been seriously harmed or killed.
But people aren't making the con see, most people aren't making the connection. I had a friend of ours,
Right.
their daughter got pregnant at the same time as her sister-in-law.
Right.
Her mother-in-law is a pediatrician. She gave her sister-in-law a note for her, a letter for her job, saying that it was not in her best interest as an expectant mother to take the injection, so she didn't have to take the injection. our friend's daughter took the injection. She had a stillbirth.
Right.
She was traumatized by it, and so was her daughter, because her daughter was expecting, I want to be a big sister.
Right.
So this happens, and so, but nobody talks about that. So I'm not going to say to her mother and her father, see, if she hadn't taken that wouldn't have happened.
Right. But then how do you try and get them not to take another one? Can you?
Well, all you can do is say, you know, look at what's coming out. What's being reported by the leaks in terms of the Pfizer leaks. Just take a look at that. You can't beat them over the head with it. You can't. I mean, I used to send people linkages to articles and things like that. I wouldn't hear from them anymore.
Right.
You know, so, I mean, it's like, you know, when you're a kid, you know, somebody's talking to you, nah, 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 they're closing, nah, nah, nah.
Right, but you still are planting a seed. Oftentimes.
Yeah, that's all you can do is plant the seed.
Right.
And hope that they value your integrity enough that at least they will give you an opportunity. It's like, okay, I hear what you're saying. A friend of mine's son is an orthopedic surgeon in Texas. His son is telling him all this kind of stuff that, well, you and mom, you need to do this, you need to do that. And so when I was telling him early on about it, he was like, you're telling me this is not true? I said, no, I'm not telling you it's not true. I'm just saying that you need to, you know, dig a little deeper into what's going on. But his son, who is very successful, is telling them. So they bought into it mainly because most doctors, if you don't believe in it, if you don't, you're going to lose your license.
So,
I'm not trying to be negative. I'm just saying this is what we're up against.
Well, in 1998, when I started to see the money disappearing,
mm-hmm.
you know, I would have several colleagues who were saying, why are you yapping about this? Nobody's interested. And I kept saying, if we don't deal with this, then they will have no other choice but to bring down life expectancy. You know, if you look at the mathematical formula, you either increase savings, you either increase the retirement age, or you bring down life expectancy. It's a mathematical formula. If we're not going to do savings, then we have to do one or both of the others. It's a fait accompli. And every year that goes by, you get lock-in to the negative.
Right.
You know, you have to go there. You have to So if you look at the organization that's running the injections, it's the same organization that disappeared $20 trillion. It's one in the same organization. That's not an accident. So every year, and it's funny because I have certain colleagues who think I'm like a broken record and who say, yeah, you know, and they couldn't relate to it because it was so far off in the future.
Right.
And I kept saying, no, this is an emergency. It's like amortization. If you don't deal with this now, then, you know, we all die out here. Mm. You know, it's how many people have to get killed out here to make this work. It's a formula. And but nobody could relate. And so now, you know, so when you get to the point where you're dealing with a real genocide, you know, could I envision it was a genocide? Of course. It's not.
Right.
This is math.
Well, but see, you had enough cachet and credibility that people believed you. So with Mark Skidmore, the gentleman from Michigan, they ran the numbers and they said, okay, I got this from Catherine Austin Fitz. Here's the real deal. These are the people who are taking our money.
Right.
So you went from you to somebody else who documented he and his associates. So that's progress.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Now, they haven't made the linkages that you've made in terms of the quality of life of people, but that's how it works. So for me, I'm looking at my friends and family. They drank the Kool-Aid. But I think some of them now are starting to see, because all of a sudden some of them are getting sick,
Right.
right? Now, I'm not talking about the ones that are in my generation. I'm talking about their children.
So there's been a big debate in the freedom community about somebody came up with a theory called mass formation, and the idea that we all just went crazy together, and that's what happened. You know, and it was the psychological eruption of the people that caused the leadership to do this, and we all just went crazy together, and you know, now it's over. Anyway, but somebody married it with psychosis. So there's this thing that we're dealing with a psychological phenomena. Now, when I target a group of people with neurological grade military weapons, you know, basically military mind control, I don't blame them for psychological eruption. So I have a hard time. You know, to me, part of this is a cover story for the kind of
Of
mind
course,
control
of course,
operation we're dealing with.
of course.
Right. So
But
so there was this big brouhaha, and the sort of the final decision was a wonderful paper that Whitney Webb's website published called Mass Atrocity versus Mass Formation. And the conclusion is we're in the middle of a mass atrocity. And the numbers are, I mean, if you look at all the reports of people dying, if you look at all the
mental
polls, if you
health
look
and
at the
all the other
surveys,
things.
if you look at the insurance companies, if you look at the funeral directors, I mean, across the board, we're dealing with a mass atrocity. It's intentional, it's clear. And yet, Bobby Kennedy can't say that. And I find that astonishing.
Well, he's connected with the children's, was the Children's Defense Fund.
Right, so he leads the children's.
So they've been saying it,
Right.
right? But he can't come out and say that at this point in time, or he hasn't, right? But there is real evidence that the mind control is working.
Right.
And I think one of the things with the George Floyd situation, and I would tell people, I said, there folks are upset because that was another level of government overreach.
Right.
In other words, they saw the pictures that they did that on purpose,
Right.
showing that. But remember that happened, the lockdowns were going on.
Right.
People were in the house. So the demonstrations gave them an excuse to get out of the house, but they were demonstrating against George Floyd, but they really, on an indirect level, were demonstrating against government overreach. So the powers that be see this, okay, how can we adjust this so that we continue the mind control, but then we ramp down any desire on the parts of the underclass to rise up against us or to challenge the narrative. And I think that's what we're seeing now. They're just the reinforcement of the narrative, despite all the things that you just said about the funeral directors, insurance companies, personal anecdotal experiences, and all that. It's just,
So I
whew.
don't, you know, to me the mass atrocity is the great poisoning, of which the injections are only a piece. You know, if you look at the poisoning that's going on, it's much bigger. And it's been
And more
going on
pervasive too.
more pervasive, you know, the spraying and the food and, you know, all of these different things. Now, so again, I come back to the speech. I'm listening to the speech and I'm realizing I'm in a world where I'm expected to pretend that there's not a mass atrocity happening, which is happening right now as we speak every day. I'm watching a group of people being depowered and depopulated, and I'm expected to pretend it's not happening. How do I lead through that?
Well, the old, John the Baptist, one crying in the wilderness. So you look at the prophets, they either intuited or they, Bible constantly says the word of the Lord came to so-and-so, or God spoke to so-and-so in a dream. So we get divine
downloads, right?
Messages all the time.
Right.
It's just a very few of us actually act on them in terms of the greater good. So what you have to do is have the courage, because it took courage to be different. It right. took courage for somebody to say, okay, you know, and I oftentimes the situation I'm in now, I call it the Jonah syndrome, where this has to be done, but I don't want to do it. So I try to flee, and then all kinds of stuff happens, and then and lo and behold, I end up back on having to do it anyway.
Yeah.
So that's what we have to do. We have to accept this reality. This is what's going on.
So when I listened to Bobby's speech, because I'm a great admirer of Kennedy, I think he's done remarkable things, and I think what he's trying to do now is a very good thing. He's trying to open up the conversation.
Right. Right.
In a big way.
He has to lay the foundation.
Right. And so, you know, I think everything he's doing is terrific, and I'm very glad he's doing it. But I listened to him and I said, okay, somebody's got to be the bad guy and talk about mass atrocity and all these other things, and that's me. I'm going to do that.
Right.
Because it's got to happen. But it's also got to happen in a way that is, you know, you have to do it as a leader, not as a... I'm not the town crier. You know what I mean?
Right. Right.
You got to do it as a leader. And you don't want to overwhelm people. You really don't. Because it doesn't help.
No.
It doesn't help to overwhelm.
No.
You got
They're already overwhelmed anyway.
Right, exactly. So you've got to help them, you know, you've got to help them with what they've got in front of them today and tomorrow and the next day.
Right. But see, when you empower people, and no one can really empower another person, but what you do is you encourage them to flip their own switch.
Right.
Look at what's in you. Look at what you have done in the past. Look at the challenges and obstacles you've overcome. You can do it again because the same energy is in you. And this is why you need to do it for yourself, your family, and for the community. That's the message. And yes, the external world is going to come against you. As you talk about Bobby Kennedy, the person I admired in the last cycle was Marianne Williamson.
Right.
Right. And nobody took her seriously because she was talking about spiritual solutions to.
Well, she's running again, I think.
I know, yeah. But the thing is, they just ignored her.
Right.
Right. They just wrote her off and she's a crackpot, just mamby-pamby, you know, sees the world through rose-colored glasses. But here she is running again.
Right.
Right. And so that same type of tenacity and perseverance, because she's integrous to what she believes in.
Right.
And that's all you can do.
Right. Yeah, that is true. That's all you can do. So one thing I would say is I've noticed if you look at, you know, in my prayer time, if you look at sort of the what it takes me to kind of really connect in again, you know, sort of plug in and really feel like, you know, I've been hanging out with the Lord, you know, it's getting harder and harder. And I kind of feel like there's a deterioration in the general field that makes it harder to punch through. Does that make any sense?
Makes sense. But you have to look at that, look at yourself, look at where you are, and then say, okay, how badly do I want this? And of course, obviously you want it.
Right.
So, okay, now what do I have to do to make this connection more intense?
Right.
And it may mean you have to go shut everything down, just, you know, just get into a real meditative state. You may have to do whatever you do to feel that connection.
Right.
Because that's what empowers you. That's the whole thing with, you know, Jesus. I call him Yeshua, but He said, come ye apart. Just get quiet.
Right.
Move. Don't let the world penetrate right now.
Right. I need more time in prayer.
Right.
That's right.
And so, and you need, remember the mountaintop experience. You go up on a mountain, you're by yourself.
Right.
Right. So whether you're Moses, whether you're Joshua, whether you're Yeshua, you come down and you're immediately faced with a crisis. That's right. Why you go up there.
Right.
I mean, but you know, you don't know what the crisis is, but once you come off of that mountaintop experience, boom. But
then you have,
but you have the, you have what you right. need, and you're prepared.
It's like going picking up your tools.
Yeah.
If you're an electrician, you can't go out there without your tools. So you got to go pick up your tools.
Don't walk to the job and leave your truck with all your tools in it.
Okay, so back to you on leadership. What were the things in your, you talked about your mom. What were the other things over the last, let's just hold to the last 20 years, that most helped you keep your balance and keep doing that leadership thing?
I think it's an internal drive. I've always been an optimist.
Right.
And it's like, okay, that happened. So now what am I going to do?
Right.
How am I going to transition from this? Or how am I going to, John Wooden had a quote, things turn out the best for the people who make the best of the way things turn out. So you're—
Say that again.
Things turn out for the best. For the people who make the best of the way things turn out.
Right.
So you're in a situation that's not to your liking. How do I navigate this?
Right.
How do I stop from being off kilter? How do I make sure that my internal compass is aligned the way it's supposed to be? Now, that's not going to be constant due north all the time.
Right.
Or it will be, but you'll get distracted, and then you have to come back to it and say, okay, here it is. Let me get right.
Right.
But that's the challenge, because life will present you with challenges, obstacles, setbacks, heartache, disappointment. You'll even be betrayed by people that right. you thought were your friends.
Right. And that's how I always learn how the money works, is betrayal. Betrayal is always the doorway
right.
to some profound insight about mm-hmm. money.
Well, the thing is, how many people, see, to me, life is a school. So right. every situation is a lesson.
You're just getting to the next grade.
Yeah, yeah. like we used to play dumb school on the steps.
Right.
But so those lessons are an integral part of your development. They're supposed to happen to you. Now, how many people attempt to learn the lesson? Most people are so bitter that, you know, you always have a choice. You can be bitter or you can be better. So most people tend to be so disappointed, so down, they don't look for the silver lining.
Right.
It sounds corny, but my personal philosophies, I don't let anybody negate my experiences, because they're right. school, they're life lessons for me.
Well, one of the great sermons that really helped me was hearing somebody says, if you lose your love, you lose your power.
Mm.
Can't.
Mm.
And that's what bitterness does.
Right.
It kills
right.
your love.
Right. Right.
You
right.
can't do that.
Right.
It's like turning off right. the energy source.
Right. Right. And after a while, it gets so layered over that you forget it's there, or it becomes, in your mind, less intense.
Right.
When the fact of the matter is, it's there. Like, we all have it.
Right.
But most people just don't pay any attention to it.
So I want to ask you, who are the leaders? You know, because I'm when I get sort of befuddled by something, I'll go watch a video or read a speech by somebody who inspires me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have a hero every week. On the Salier Report, they always, right. These are people who personally inspire me. So who do you go listen to? Who inspires you?
Someone like Martin Luther King Jr. Not for the reasons that many people would think. The last year of his life, he was under immense pressure.
Right.
You know, and they targeted him. They did everything they could to make him kill himself. But then he became persona non grata. How did you make it through that? How did you do what you did despite the fact that everybody said, man, you need to get off of that. Leave that alone. Don't you stick with civil rights. Don't get into the war. Don't get into foreign policy. Yet he was due north. Now, people say, well, that's crazy. Why would you want to lionize somebody who got killed? Well, death is inevitable. It's unavoidable. We're all going to leave here for one reason or another. So why not live your life in such a way that you're true to what you believe and you're true to what's right? And that whole notion of peace was right. So he's
Well,
one
he
of
went after the model. The civil rights, all the civil rights issues are part of a symptom of a model, and he went after the model.
them.
And that's what that's where they always kill you, when you go after the model.
And he was able to make the connections and the linkages between what was going on domestically and what was going on
Internationally.
internationally. So they said, oh, no, we can't have that.
Well, that's what we were talking about earlier, that their challenge is playing the domestic game along with the international game, and it depends on so much secrecy. And so when you start busting through, you start making it transparent, which is what he was doing, that they don't like people skipping their lane.
And they don't like people pulling the curtain back.
But over the last 20 years, we've been able to pull back a lot of curtains. So we're just about to pull back a lot more.
You know what? Some I came upon something called the Violence Initiative. It was VI something. And it was about how these scientists, quote unquote scientists, were planning to, they were looking at black people saying they're violent, they're like Reese's monkeys. And we need to do this, this, and this. And so they had this program where they were going
Oh, I saw this. Did you send it to me?
to,
I saw
might
this.
have, but
You might have.
somebody sent it to me and I wrote articles about it. And all of a sudden, it took off. Now, I'm not saying it took off because of me, but people became more and more aware of it and it was shut down. So, and I'm just using that example as say, okay, one person can make a difference because we're taught you can't fight City Hall and win.
You can.
That's not true. We win all the time. It's just that we tend to celebrate and the evildoers go back to the drawing board. It's like, okay, that, yeah.
Well, they don't celebrate our victories, so we have to
Right,
learn to
right,
celebrate
right.
our own
So,
victories. Okay, well, Genius, it's always a pleasure to see you.
Hey.
I enjoy your company
Love you.
immensely. I do think of you as a leader. I know you say you don't think of yourself as a leader, but I do think that you embody.
I think I'm a natural born leader, but when I look around, I don't see hordes of people behind me. That's the thing. And in fact, my history is I'll go out on a limb, I look back, and the people I thought were behind me are
They're
sawing me
sawing.
off.
See, a great leader knows how to land on the grass and bounce
Yeah. Or
back.
you learn from if you survive that, okay. I know.
Anyway, so it's been a great conversation, and I look forward to your next one. I'm always telling people about the little tidbits I get in your interviews. So I'll just tell one. I love the one, the Reverend,
Which
about the
one?
4-year-old.
Oh yeah, about the guy.
So the 4-year-old, his parents have a new baby. They bring the baby home, and the 4-year-old comes to the parents and says, "Can I talk to the baby alone?" And they're like, that's a very uncomfortable question to you. Why does he want to talk to the baby? Because you hear about kids being competitive with the new baby. So they have a baby monitor, and they realize, okay, it's safe because we can listen in on the monitor. If something goes wrong, we'll run in the room. So they listen to their 4-year-old. So they 4-year-old goes in the room with the baby by himself, shuts the door, and walks up to the crib and says, "Tell me about God. I've almost forgotten."
Well, that's what happened.
Wow.
They say babies are just coming from the spirit world. The elders are about to re-enter it. And so in between, for the most part, they're the ones closest. Because those of us who are in the middle, in between, a lot of us have forgotten.
So that was, but you just did another interview that was very successful with a gentleman who,
Naeem,
Naeem.
Naeem.
I really love that one because I said, you know, here's a guy who's lived through the beatdown. And if we haven't lived through the beatdown, we're going
You're
to.
right.
And so it's a great description of, okay, here's how real leaders deal with the beatdown.
And in Camden, at a time when Camden was really, now, the beatdown happened so that the transformation, so the money can be shifted around and priorities can be shifted or whatever. So Camden is quote unquote now on the rise. But when he was out there, oh, when he
Camden,
first,
I've never seen a worse beatdown than Camden. I've never seen a worse
But
beatdown.
remember when we were talking to the gentleman, we were talking about the, from Chester, we were talking about the Delaware River Corridor, how they gutted Chester, they gutted Camden. Philly was taking a hit, and Trenton took a hit.
And here's the problem with it. It's the what I call the negative return on investment. It's going to go everywhere. I mean, now that's what mass atrocity is. That's when, you know, you work out all the prototypes on these
The
beatdowns, and
models,
then now it goes.
The only thing they tweak it depending on whatever location it is, but that they have the model, then they okay, we need to make this adjustment, or this will work over there. It didn't work here, but in the general context, we can play that out, and we'll just tweak this. So we'll take down Kansas City next, or whatever, you know.
You know, there's an expression, you know, Lord, I want to know your ways, but you know, it's also to be a leader in this environment, it's also tapeworm, I want to know your ways.
But you have to study, and you have to understand, because from my perspective, and it may be simplistic and I may be wrong, but their playbook is kind of thin. They keep running the same, they're like Vince Lombardi, just keep running the same place
He
over and
did
over
pretty
again.
well. So the next year, any thoughts about what you're going to be up to for the next year?
Well, trying to maintain my health, trying to continue what I'm doing. It was interesting. I enjoyed doing the metanoia, but I've had some difficulty. I've reached out to people, they didn't get back to me, or there were some logistical problems. I found them, and one person was in South Africa, so I'm thinking, okay, well, how's this gonna work? The time changes and all that. But so I want to continue to do that. I want to get back to doing my podcast because I've been away from it since February. But there's so much stuff, and now because the internet is being scrubbed, I don't know if you're aware of this. I
It's
mean, we're
unbelievable.
living,
It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable.
I call it the 1984 protocols, where they're just going in, just scrubbing stuff off the internet.
Amazing.
So that becomes a challenge. Now I got to spend more time looking for stuff. The name of the game is, okay, you tell the search engines you have to be more precise. You just can't type something in there. Now you have to be real precise to get what you're looking for. So,
It's back to notebooks. Okay, well, Junius Ricardo Stanton, thank you for joining us on this Salieri Report. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us. You have a great day.
Be safe and stay strong. Remember, the power is within you.